Drupal Voices is a series of interviews with people contributing to the Drupal community. Brought to you by Lullabot Consulting. Whether you need technical architecture, developer support, optimization and analysis, on-site training, or just general guidance for your Drupal project, Lullabot has led many of the largest Drupal projects in the world. Visit lullabot.com or call 877-LULLABOT to find out how we can help you with your next project.
I'm Clay Shirky. I teach theory and practice of social media at the Interactive Telecommunications Program at NYU, and I just joined the journalism department at NYU. And the two big points of the talk I just gave were, one, when we see technologies that have really different characteristics from what we're used to, and the example I started with was the steam engine, what we learn is that we can't just add those technologies to existing systems and have the existing systems work better and faster. The example from the steam engine, the history of the steam engine I use, is the fact that the first working steamboat developed by John Fitch, the guy who invented it, was the fourth attempt he'd had. The first attempt he had at a steamboat, he actually tried to make the steam engine row oars at just replacing the humans. And what he learned over time is that the steam engine actually required a redesign of the boat itself. It couldn't just be dropped into the boat. So the parallel I'm making is that as we are socializing businesses that were previously run mainly by managerial oversight and where the individual users or customers or whatever weren't involved with each other, as we take those businesses and build them instead on social platforms, what we're learning is that things we call content management systems actually require a re-engineering of the business or a rethinking of the services being offered. The second thing I was trying to do around that point was to pick three specific examples of what I think the redesign were. One was the idea that once we add participation, the difference in behaviors of various users occupies such a wide spectrum. You know, some people incredibly passionate, other people just barely contributing something and then taking off, that our concept of the user as a sort of a solo concept is breaking down. The second observation is that we can increasingly target behavior rather than people as the object of the context the system is setting. So I use the example of delicious setting cues so that spam, it wasn't so much that they got rid of spam or got rid of spammers as they made the spam inert. The spam was on the system, but the other users didn't notice, leading to the tree in the woods question. If you have spam on a system and the users don't care, is it really spam? And then the third, the most speculative of the three observations, was the possibility of users really owning their own system as full-fledged, not just members, but participants in the design and redesign of the system. And I used Stack Exchange and MySpace condos as examples of places where users are increasingly not just feeling a sense of ownership, as passionate users always do, but actually having a sense of ownership in the systems.
So it sounds like there's this principle of almost iteration. You can almost expect that you're not going to get it right the first time. Absolutely. And you're going to have to adapt. So maybe you could sort of talk about that.
Well, the principle of iteration is, I think, fundamental to a lot of these changes. I mean, the thing that the open source movement in general does better than closed source is it fails faster and more visibly. And so you can try lots and lots and lots of things at relatively low cost, and the community can fairly quickly discard the failed attempts and integrate the successful attempts without a huge amount of overhead. And so iterative development as a challenge to the heavy upfront planning waterfall development model has been a commonality of these systems. What I think is surprising is that what open source learned about iterative development and rapid public failure is actually turning out to help us figure out how to redesign other systems as well. So I use the example of my friend Richard Nash, who's launching a new publishing site called Red Lemonade, which has the web at the center and assumes social life among the readers from the beginning. And Nash knows perfectly well, he's the first novel that they're publishing comes out on May 1st, Nash knows perfectly well that by August, they're going to know bunches of stuff that they should have done but didn't, and bunches of other stuff that they did do but shouldn't have, and still bunches of other stuff that they did okay but they could do much better. And the question of whether Red Lemonade is success or failure isn't going to be the first 3 months of existence when they launch their first three novels. The question of whether Red Lemonade is success is whether they learn enough and are able to integrate it quickly enough that they can modify the system to be the thing they really actually should have launched in the beginning, but couldn't know or couldn't understand until they had the trial version.
So what are the things that people should be watching or listening for, or, you know, looking at the power users, or what should they be looking at, and then how should they then respond and then kind of redesign things?
Well, you know, that's really a domain-specific question. In fact, we were just having a conversation before this about how funny it is in the sciences that the physicists have had this thing, archive.org, distributing preprint research since the 1980s, but that, you know, biologists and geologists and poets and painters are still not, even when they're employed by the academy, still not adopting the same model of sort of early sharing and academic community. So questions like that are very often one community at a time or one domain at a time. That having been said, I think what you said, pay attention to what the power users are doing and watch out for or try to design systems that give the power users power tools, right? My friend Jerry Mikowski often says this. Jerry is an incredible bumblebee, a connector of different kinds of ideas across really disparate domains. And he knows and keeps track of thousands and thousands of projects using essentially a piece of mind mapping software called The Brain. And he often says, there are not many people like me because the world doesn't need many people like me, but it does need people like me to do our jobs well. And yet, no one designs tools for Jerry to do Jerry's job especially well, a Rolodex that essentially suggests or helps draw connections that are implicit but not otherwise visible. And that, I think that possibility of actually looking at your user base and saying, if we could give 10% leverage to the top 10% most active users, how much better would we be? And in many cases, the system would become surprisingly more dynamic and effective than giving the same interface to everybody.
Yeah, I mean, you've done a lot of work with Here Comes Everybody and sort of collaboration, and there's also like this sense of like the power law curve dynamics of like, even with Drupal, Dries was giving a slide that over 50% of the development on Drupal 7 was done by like 30 developers. And
right.
So it does seem like if you are able to sort of empower these people that are at the top, then you can sort of create amazing things.
Yep, and that curve is normal, and both parts are normal, which is to say, most of the contributors will contribute one or a couple of things, and most of the contributions will come from a small core of incredibly committed users. We've always known that in, you know, traditional 80-20, 20 rules around management, right? Keep the people who are doing most of the work, get rid of everybody else. What the surprise that the open source movement and the open access movement more generally has shown us is that you actually get a healthier ecosystem if you have both the intense contributors and the long tail of one-off contributions put together make a better ecosystem than trying to concentrate on either maximizing the number of participants or maximizing code commits per participant.
And you've also written about cognitive surplus. So, you know, how would you sort of take the principles of cognitive surplus and kind of apply them to like the Drupal community? What should people within the Drupal community know about that principle?
Well, the argument of cognitive surplus is, I think, going to be absolutely core to the Drupal community, which is we have these large-scale projects, this coordinated voluntary participation, where a resource is created by people freely contributing their time and talents. And plainly, any project like Drupal rests on that. I think the key thing for the Drupal community to understand, and this is best explained by Yochai Benkler in his paper, Coase's Penguin, is that the ways to make systems like that work are on the input side to work on modularity, granularity, and low-cost integration. So modularity means there are a lot of different ways to participate. Granularity means you can participate in large or small ways, right? I can contribute an entire module, I can contribute a single bug fix, and both of those are possible. And integration means that actually taking a rolling low-cost method at integrating those commits and looking at the results rather than having elaborate and expensive dot version releases as your only way of advancing the code base means that you can do continuous integration of even a large number of small changes. On the participation side, Benkler also said, loosely coupled systems require motivated actors, meaning that anything you can do to reward people with the personal motivations of autonomy and competence, right? I did this myself, I did this well. And with a sense of membership and generosity, right? I'm part of this community that recognizes I'm part of it, and they regard my contributions as beneficial for the whole. Those things can't be backed out into money. They're not the same as money, but people will do amazing things for this sense of autonomy and competence, or for this sense of membership and generosity. So that's not so much about designing the platform around, you know, granular code commits and rapid integration. That's rather designing the community around a sense of, we know what kinds of contributions matter, and we reward the people socially who produce those contributions regularly.
And right now, it's at DrupalCon in the spring, and there's kind of like the smell of revolution in the air around the world, and with Egypt and all sorts of different countries in Africa. And so technology is sort of playing some role in that, but what do you see as sort of the big lessons for either technologists or the Drupal community to help sort of, you know, what part do we have to kind of play in that?
So the big lesson, disappointingly in a way for the kind of weekend warrior model, the big lesson is that the heavy lifting done by social media tends to be done before people turn out in the streets, right? That everybody looked at all of the material streaming out of Tunisia, all of the material streaming out of Egypt, the documentation of things at the time, the incredible thrilling images from Tahrir Square in Cairo and so forth. And that looks like the main event. But when you look at Egypt, what you see is the so-called kafaya movement. It means enough in Arabic, was an attempt to create a virtual space, the blogosphere, in which secular and Islamic groups who all agreed that they wanted Mubarak out could come together and create a joint opposition. And it was that long-term building up of social capital and the public sphere that actually enabled the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt to essentially become revolutions, right? It wasn't just that they turned people out in a protest, but that those people knew each other and trusted each other. But once they turned out in the street was where the action was. It wasn't the internet anymore. It served some use as a coordinating and documenting tool. But the important action is beforehand. So for somebody who wants to see this pattern spread, to see the ability of insurgents demanding more representative government to do better, it makes much more sense to pick a country under an autocratic government and befriend somebody there, right? Strike up a communication, pick some language you have in common. There are efforts to improve connectivity in those environments, not around the incredible moment when the state tries to shut the internet off, but just in terms of daily life. Because the density of communication and the ability of those people to reach outside of, you know, the kind of traditional radius of their physical communications to communicate it on a wider scope actually has turned out to matter to surprising degrees. So it's not the, you know, anonymous style excitement of low orbit ion cannons and DDoS attacks on Iranian servers or whatever. It's really much more just the patient business of building connections between people in different countries and creating a kind of international movement in which concern for other people's freedom and the willingness to route messages, to offer advice, to offer help, to offer funding for NGOs working in those regions. It's that long patient work that matters more really than the, you know, tuning in on Twitter when the shooting starts.
Right. And you've also done quite a bit of writing about journalism in general and sort of like the role of technology in journalism. And Drupal is a platform that more and more news organizations are starting to adopt. And so how do you see this sort of like infusion of open source technologies into the journalism world helping to kind of like sustain this journalism that is so critical?
I'm not sure that the thing that matters about Drupal and those organizations is the fact that it's open source. Plainly, it couldn't be what it is if it weren't open source, but I don't think it will be the open source culture that changes the journalistic newsroom. What I think it will be is that Drupal will come into those organizations as a content management system, right? It's this kind of idea of either we're replacing Vignette or we're having some other way to serve up these files. But that over time, the ability to use it as a platform for convening the audience, for putting them in touch with each other, for supporting a community, will probably end up being the long-term value. And I think the fact that Drupal gets into these organizations as a CMS, which is to say as a kind of mentally innocuous model, but actually encapsulates really radical possibilities of user participation, is going to end up being Drupal's big conversation.
And finally, what is sort of like your take on the Drupal community and Drupal in general, and being able to kind of like see what's happening in Drupal, and what's your impression and your kind of takeaway of Drupal?
So my friend David Eves has a very interesting observation about open source efforts, which is that they grow till they shrink. They get bigger and bigger. Something that starts and is successful attracts more people who contribute more to the code base, and the code base grows and it takes on more features until finally it gets too big. And I don't mean the code base gets too big. I mean the community gets too big. And no one can propose any change without treading on someone else's toes. And the whole thing gets to what's sometimes called midlife loss of generality. And at that moment, these projects tend to reshrink and to go to a plug-in and module model where the core function, whether it's the Linux kernel or the rendering engine in a web browser or what have you, the core function is then dramatically reduced, and there are hooks and APIs and other ways of getting external modules, plugins, what have you, extensions to tie into the code base. And Drupal seems to me to be doing a really good job of that kind of extensibility, of saying essentially not everybody has to be in the same place all at once. In fact, the strength of the platform, if it's going to remain general, is that more and more of its functions that are critical to the organizations that use it should be both available to and customizable by those organizations without having to have everybody argue about the future direction of Drupal. And once you go to that model, the future of direction of Drupal can actually be in multiple directions at once. And that's what interests me so much about Drupal in general, and in particular about 7. Dries and I spent some time talking about 7 when I interviewed him for MIT a couple of years ago. And it seems to be working well, to my eye, to have a platform that allows for more of this Drupal's heading in several directions at once.
Cool. Well, thanks.
Great. Thank you.